and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
We had to start this war, you just said, 60 days ago.
The war in Iran reaches the 60-day mark. Will President Trump need congressional approval going forward? And The Onion and InfoWars, a strange pairing, but the Chicago-based satirical site finally has a deal to take over Alex Jones' far-right former platform. First off tonight, the U.S. Supreme Court strikes a blow to racially based redistricting. The case came from Louisiana, where the population is about one-third black. It had just one congressional district out of six with a majority of black voters. A lower court had ordered the map to be redrawn to include two black majority districts. Now the Supreme Court says that order was unconstitutional. The three liberal justices dissented and said, in the words of Justice Elena Kagan, that minority citizens in Louisiana and elsewhere may, quote, no longer have an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. Florida lawmakers quickly acted to pass a new congressional map today that could lead to four more Republican-leaning districts there. Democrats and others are expected to challenge that map in court. Governor J.B. Pritzker is sounding off on a judge's decision to release a defendant on electronic monitoring. The defendant, Alfonso Talley, is now facing charges that he allegedly shot two Chicago police officers, one of them fatally. Pritzker, though, stopped short of blaming the state's Safety Act, which ended cash bail.
As you've seen, in most of the cases where Republicans have complained about the Safety Act, it's actually been the bad decision by an elected judge in Illinois or no hearing at all because the prosecutor didn't bring it to the judge. And that has been a reason why somebody gets let out. A judge can make this decision. A judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
According to reports, Talley had an arrest warrant pending for violating his electronic monitoring before Saturday's shooting at Endeavor Health Swedish Hospital. Pritzker's comments come a day after Cook County State's attorney called out electronic monitoring, calling the system broken. Chicago officer John Bartholomew was killed in Saturday's shooting, and another officer remains in critical condition. Spending on overtime cost Chicago taxpayers a little less in 2025 compared to the year before. A WTTW News analysis shows the city spent over $544 million on employee overtime. That's more than 6% less than in 2024. About half of that amount was to pay Chicago police officers for working extra hours. For 2026, CPD has budgeted $200 million for OT, but already spent nearly $61 million of that in the first 3 months of 2026. To finish on budget, the department would have to reduce spending on overtime by 30%. The case of the so-called Broadview 6 is getting a downgrade. Federal prosecutors have dismissed the felony conspiracy charges against the remaining four people still facing charges related to their protests against immigration enforcement efforts at the ICE facility in Broadview. The government says they instead intend to file only misdemeanor charges against former political candidate Kat Abugazale and others, many of whom are either local elected officials or were candidates for local office. The case had been among the highest profile incidents stemming from the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz last fall. In a social media statement, Abugazale says, quote, "This is a huge win. This case has cost myself and others immeasurable amounts of stress, money, and opportunity." Who doesn't love a baby rhino? A few Lincoln Park Zoo supporters got the first look at baby Hazina. Mom Kapuki gave birth to Hazina on March 19th. The little pachyderm clocked in at, get this, 60 pounds when she was born and is now around 130 pounds. That's because she can pack on about 100 pounds a month. Eastern black rhinoceroses are critically endangered species due to poaching, but efforts in the last 25 years have boosted their population to around 1,000 mature individuals in the wild. Up next, a look at the war in Iran 60 days since it first began. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
This week marks 60 days since the start of the war in Iran. Under the 1973 War Powers Resolution, the president needs congressional approval to continue military action after 60 days, though he is allowed an additional 30-day extension. The U.S. and Iran are in negotiations after the two countries agreed to a ceasefire. However, President Donald Trump has made threats of further escalation after rejecting a potential agreement earlier today. Joining us to talk about all of this are Ibrahim Abu Sharif, journalism and Middle Eastern studies professor at Northwestern University and author of Social Media, Religious Authority, and the Arab Gulf Crisis. Richard Porter, an attorney and longtime member of the Republican National Committee from Illinois. He was a White House advisor to President George H.W. Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle. And Raf Donaldson, professor of law and philosophy at the Chicago Kent College of Law with a specialization in constitutional law. Gentlemen, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard, let's start with you first. Where would you say negotiations stand right now between the White House and Iran?
Well, I think that what we're looking for is a surrender, essentially. And so I don't really think, I think the negotiation is window dressing. They want to give the Iranians some face-saving avenue out by agreeing to basically surrender. Surrender worked out well for Japan after World War II. It's the right move for Iran. The rial was crashing today. It's almost worthless. They've almost run out of space to hold the oil that they've been pumping. Once they run out of space and they have to cap out those wells, it could have real damage to the petroleum industry in Iran. So it's time for Iran to smell the coffee and agree to some terms.
The president has said they're going to have to cry uncle. What is his strategy here?
His strategy is to really lean on them. He's got them on the ground, and they're pinned, and he's slowly choking it out until they realize that they've got to tap it out. They can tap the floor and be done with it.
Ibrahim.
Well, I have a different point of view on that. I think negotiations has nothing to do with surrender. And what it does is, are you going to give, are you going to take? So the Iranians are more than willing to give up, I think, their nuclear ambitions, although they will not release their right to have nuclear enrichment. So I think we're looking at messaging here that's erratic. I mean, one point Donald Trump seems conciliatory, and another point he wants surrender. And so I don't think that we can read the situation simply by what the White House puts out, what those at the apex of American political and military power are saying, because the messages are mixed. So I don't think Iran's going to surrender. If this is what they're waiting for, they'll be waiting for decades.
According to a Reuters poll, just 34% of Americans approve of this conflict, making it one of the lowest approval ratings for any war in American history. Ibrahim, to you first, what does that mean for the Trump administration?
Well, it used to mean a lot more before, but right now I think this administration depends on bluster and rhetoric that seems to satisfy their own moods and egos. So right now this has to ultimately go to legislations, it has to go to the law. Because, if they're really concerned about the midterms, then they have to pay attention to that. However, the minds that are making decisions on the ground seem to have little respect for what the polls are saying, unfortunately.
Yeah, so, we're going to come back to the impact on the midterms as well. Briefly, Richard, what do you think all of this means for the Trump administration?
Well, I think they're going to hang in there until they get the job done. And I think it's possible that they'll go back to some more kinetic action. You know, bringing the bombs back if they don't get any further progress. They will open the Straits of Hormuz, and so that sooner or later, this will come to an end. I think they'd like to get it done without putting any more American lives at risk. One of the most striking things about this whole engagement has been the extent to which President Trump has been trying to avoid U.S. casualties by avoiding putting troops on the ground in Iran, putting them in harm's way. And I think he's trying to finish this up without putting boots on the ground. It might be that at the end they have to do some more work in that regard.
Raf Donaldson, Friday marks 60 days since the start of the war. The 1973 War Powers Resolution says that Congress would have to approve any continued action either within these 60 days or after an additional 30-day extension. What options are on the table for Congress here?
So Congress, assuming that the War Powers Act is constitutional, Congress has a couple of options. So the War Powers Act itself says that Congress can, at any period, whether within the 60 days or without, call the troops back and end the action by a resolution of the Congress. So that's one option that they have. It's not clear, however, if they're really the votes to do that, at least at this time. Congress also can defund the war. They can choose not to continue spending. Congress has the power of the purse. It's also not exactly clear whether they have the political will to do that either. But those are the two basic options that Congress has at this time.
Okay. So, Richard, as we mentioned, we're coming up on the midterms with an increasingly unpopular war. Where does that leave House Republicans?
Well, I think that they're just, as a matter of principle, not going to leave the president hanging on this engagement. I think there's some people that are unhappy with the war. There's a split within the overall movement because there has been some sense of isolationism among some in the right. There's concern about having boots on the ground in endless wars. What I think Donald Trump has been able to pull off so far is a remarkable amount of work in terms of defanging Iran without having any troops on the ground. And it shouldn't be a long-term engagement. So, I think the president's really shooting for something earlier. He wants to have this all cleaned up by the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. So I think he really wants to kick off the fall campaign season then with a victory in Iran, a victory in Venezuela, and frankly also a victory in Cuba. So we'll see. I mean, I think that he wants to wrap it up, but he's willing to wait it out if he has to.
So Department of War or Department of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, he testified on Capitol Hill today, sparring with lawmakers, including, here he is, well, sparring with lawmakers over why the war started. Here he is with Representative Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington.
Their nuclear facilities have been obliterated. Underground, they're buried, and we're watching them 24/7. So we know where any nuclear material might be.
Reclaiming my time for a quick second here. We had to start this war, you just said, 60 days ago, because the nuclear weapon was an imminent threat. Now you're saying that it was completely obliterated?
They had not given up their nuclear ambitions, and they had a conventional shield of thousands of
missiles. So Operation Midnight Hammer accomplished nothing of substance. It left us at exactly
the
same place we were before.
Okay, so there's been some conflicting reports from the intelligence community as well before and after the war started. Former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Joe Kent, resigned, saying that Iran had posed no imminent threat to the U.S., though acting CIA director John Ratcliffe said that there is a constant threat. Ibrahim, how solid are the reasons for the war, and do you think that the messaging is landing with the general public?
Well, first of all, I think the messaging is not landing because it's not based on something that's real. Because Iran was not a threat to the United States. It was not an imminent threat. And Iran's and nuclear ambitions did not include the bomb. And if this was the case, they would have had it. And so for the last 25 years, Iran is, in a very bizarre twist of time, spatial realities, was 2 weeks away from having a bomb. And so that rhetoric has to stop, because it's untrue, because we're talking about cleaning up continue with the kinetic operations in Iran. We're talking about killing people, about civilians, like the schoolgirls who died in the very first early days of the war. And so Iran, I think for 40 years, Iran has been demonized in American Western mentality. And so when you're demonized and when your humanity is changed or convert it into an abstraction, you can do whatever you want with them. But I think right now, the Iranian messaging system is probably better, more mature than the Americans. I'm not an apologist for Iran. I'm not an apologist for any repressive regime in the world. But I do think that Iran is a victim here. The United States attacked Iran, and we can never forget that. I think the whole notion that there are imminent threat to the United States is utter nonsense.
Richard Porter?
So the whole death to America thing was made up? I mean, come on, that's ridiculous.
Well,
there's no reason to have 60% refined uranium other than to make bombs. And they can take that from 60 to 90% in less than 2 weeks. They told the U.S. negotiators they had enough uranium for 11 bombs. And they had every intention, once they dug it out, of trying to do that. And if they had the bomb, we wouldn't be able to do any of this. That's precisely why we had to go there. They have a missile that hit the Diego Garcia 2,000 miles away. They have the ability to lob nuclear weapons into Europe, and in a short period of time, they'll be able to actually hit North America. This was a real risk. It's been a real risk, and they've been blowing up Americans for 49 years. It's crazy.
Let me just say, first of all, they were not blowing up Americans. This is utter nonsense.
And I think they were.
Iran has been surrounded by American bases, and before they pulled out of Afghanistan, completely surrounded by American bases. Its only pathway to preserve its sovereignty is to use the threat of nuclear weapons. Right. Well, it's and never been serious that way.
So we got to talk about the Constitution, Raph, because what is the precedent when it comes to the War Powers Resolution, and how have past presidents dealt with it?
So past presidents have dealt with this in a couple of ways. Most presidents have not conceded that it's constitutional, and there are a number of scholars, including myself, who think that there are some constitutional issues with the War Powers Resolution. President Obama actually is one president who actually conceded that the resolution is constitutional, but most presidents have, despite those qualms, have attempted to follow the framework that it sets up. So as we mentioned at the top, there's a framework that the War Powers Resolution sets up that says essentially presidents have 60 days to conduct military action, and then they can either seek explicit explicit authorization from Congress, or they can pull out, or they can do another 30 days to essentially wind down the operations. So that's...
Is the president likely to take advantage of those 30 days? And if so, then what is Congress likely to do in about 20 seconds?
So the president is likely to take the extra time. The deadline is coming up. And I imagine that Congress will probably not do very much, but allow this to continue as it has so far.
Okay, well, we'll all watch it play out then, won't we? We wouldn't have to have the three of you back to discuss it further. Ibrahim Abu-Sharif, Raph Donaldson, Richard Porter, thanks to all of you for joining us. Appreciate it. Up next, Chicago-based satirical publication The Onion reaches a new deal to take over Alex Jones's InfoWars. We're going to hear about that and the site's plans for the platform right after this. Chicago-based satirical news site The Onion is poised to finally take over InfoWars. That's the far-right platform created by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. The deal is close to 2 years in the making. About 18 months ago, The Onion won a court-mandated auction for InfoWars' parent company after Jones was found liable for defamation after calling the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting a hoax. He was ordered to pay over $1 billion in damages to the families, which he has yet to do. The acquisition has been held up in court until now. Joining us to talk about that acquisition is the executive editor of The Onion, Jordan LaFleur. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So last time you were here, this was just after you all won that bidding war for InfoWars. A lot has happened since.
That's right.
What got in the way of the acquisition?
Oh, you know, Alex Jones is a bit of a character. Threw up a lot of blockers, hurdles, but we've... been tenacious, been borrowing the tenacity of the families, the Sandy Hook families themselves, and we've just stuck with it.
To that point, why? Why be tenacious? Why keep going with this?
Oh, I think first and foremost, this is about accountability. We want to replace something that was putting a lot of, you know, negative, I'm going to go ahead and call it evil, into the world. Sorry to use such a definitive word, but I think we can replace it with something better and more beneficial to the wider world.
So what does this new agreement mean?
What does this new agreement mean? We will be taking the keys to InfoWars, and we will be replacing it with something that is a more open world comedy platform, inclusive of voices of all types.
So tomorrow in Travis County, which is where InfoWars is based, there will be a hearing on The Onion's licensing agreement. How significant is that?
Oh, it's extremely significant. We imagine this will be the definitive proceeding, and we're ready to move forward immediately.
What's going to happen at this hearing?
As I understand it, the judge will be declaring that we have the keys. We've done it. We're okay. At the finish line.
Okay. This is the big show.
That's right.
Alex Jones, he filed an emergency motion to block this deal. He and his team, as we know, as they have demonstrated, are quite litigious. Do you anticipate more legal obstacles here?
Yeah.
I imagine that Alex Jones is not going to ever give up, but I imagine he's going to have to do it on a different platform than he once did, because we've got this one now.
Okay. He and his fans, they've tried to frame this story as a free speech issue, repeatedly claiming that the defamation cases and social media bans were an assault to his First Amendment right. What do you say to people who believe this is, you know, silencing a viewpoint?
I think that people have a misunderstanding of what the First Amendment offers us as a population. It is intended to ensure that Congress makes no law abridging our speech, defaming others, causing willfully the emotional distress of people is not a privilege afforded to us. And I'm happy to play a role in diminishing that voice.
This started in part as a way to help bring justice and accountability, of course, to the
Absolutely.
Families that you've mentioned who lost their children in the tragedy of Sandy Hook. How are you continuing to work on that mission?
I think by holding the initial version of InfoWars accountable, by replacing it with a better version, I think that's the way forward.
Yeah. And are you able to explain for us the licensing agreement and how that means these families actually get paid the something of the $1 billion that he is supposed to owe, that he's supposed to be paying them?
My understanding is that, you know, their tenacity is ongoing. They will pursue Alex Jones and any earnings that he receives. The licensing agreement will allow us to generate revenue by any means we wish, and we will be giving them a portion of those.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get at. So you're able to generate revenue from the website, and some of that goes towards the families.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay. You have plans, of course, to expand your comedy network with InfoWars as another layer to the onion. Get it?
Yeah.
What can we expect?
yes, this is a new, wholly distinct operation. I mean, I don't know how interested people are in my ongoing involvement with it, but we intend to make it a more open world that allows individual creators to mimic and parody more modern internet voices. So whereas The Onion is a parody of institutional voices, we're looking forward to having a platform that allows individual creators to speak their minds.
And when you say The Onion is sort of a parody of institutional voices, you mean like sort of the typical newspaper?
That's absolutely right, yes. And particularly now that we're back in print, the focus on being a newspaper is back to being top of mind.
So the new InfoWars will be a parody of, you said, more modern voices.
That's right. I think I'll say that at first, we're thinking of it in phases. I think people are expecting a more direct parody of the existing InfoWars. We'll do that for a beat, but I think that only has so much legs, so much comedic value. In fairly short order, we intend to expand the world and again bring in some individual creators.
So do I understand you brought on some talent then who can parody Alex Jones himself?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the gentleman's name that we've brought on as creative director is Tim Heidecker, a legend in many circles. And one of his many talents is parodying Alex Jones, but he's got more talents and we'll explore all of them.
I'm sure we'll get to see all of them. I guess I'm curious about, you know, in addition to parodying Alex Jones, are you not giving Alex Jones more air by doing that?
Oh, I mean, with the brief stop on the more direct parody, I think we give people a catharsis and an opportunity to take the piss out of him. Excuse me.
All right. You've mentioned that there's been, you know, some fatigue, or you've mentioned in the past that there's been some fatigue over parodying white right-wing extremism. I can say that. And last time you were here, you also talked about, you know, the difficulty of heightening from such a place of, quote, bombast and untruth. So basically, you know, how do you plan on getting around that issue? You know, how do you sort of make fun of those folks and still be funny?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the evolution that I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. I think it was that insight that I apparently shared with you months ago that led to the idea that we can only pause on right-wing parody so long. I think people will find it cathartic to start, but over time, we want to give people an opportunity to comment more widely on a modern media ecosystem.
Just this week, Jimmy Kimmel and First Lady Melania Trump got into a squabble. Not the first time Kimmel has tussled with this White House. What do you think of, what do you think is the role of comedians at, you know, in times of political and social unrest?
I think comedy gives you a unique avenue into all manner of news stories. I think it's a way to break down a complex issue and get to the core of the matter. And I think it gives people a way to understand complex issues in a way that they would not have previously.
Okay. Do you think it's, you know, can it also be a tool for accountability in a couple of seconds?
Oh, absolutely. Comedy is maybe the best tool in media for holding people accountable. Of course, I have a biased opinion, but yes, absolutely.
Okay. Jordan LaFleur, executive editor at The Onion, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Yes, thank you so much.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. The State Commission investigating potential wrongdoing by federal immigration agents is set to deliver its final report. We hear from its leaders on what they found. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm with more than 40 years of experience in medical malpractice.